WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Nation magazine once called my guest, the Reverend Theodore Hesburgh, the most influential cleric in America. Hesburgh was only 35 years old when he was appointed president of Notre Dame University. He served an unusually long tenure, 35 years. Hesburgh prides himself on being one of the few university presidents who outlasted the student protests of the 60s. But although Hesburgh often disapproved of his students' tactics, he opposed the war in Vietnam. Throughout his tenure at Notre Dame, he remained politically active, serving on 14 presidential commissions. He chaired the Commission on Civil Rights and the Select Commission on Immigration and Refugee Policy, and served as the Vatican's representative to the International Atomic Energy Agency. Since his retirement in 1987, Hesburgh has been the president emeritus of Notre Dame. He's written a new autobiography called God, Country, Notre Dame. Since Hesburgh was in the peace movement during the Vietnam War, I asked him his thoughts on the Bush administration's current actions in the Gulf.
Well, I think the president did the right thing in getting armed forces and from a number of countries into the Gulf when this thing began. I lived in Europe at the time of Hitler, and I had the impression that if Hitler had been confronted at Munich in 1939 and told, look, you've gone as far as you're going, one more step and you're in real trouble and the whole world's going to be against you, we might have stopped the war that brought on the killing of 50 million people. I think this guy had to be stopped. Now I think we've made enough. We're in a kind of a poker game now. We put in 200, he puts in 250 new men. And I think now is the time to negotiate. So I think the president was right in doing what he did. He was right in getting a world coalition against him. I think he would be right now in getting a very sharp negotiator in there and not just go on playing poker. We put in 200, you put in 250, we put in 300, et cetera.
Do you think he'd be justified in going to war, President Bush?
I don't think anybody wants to go to war. You don't solve anything, really, by violence. A lot of misery. You probably lose the allies that are with us. Even the Russians don't want to go to war, and we always think of them as being very macho. And I don't think the French want to go to war, and certainly the Arabs feel uneasy shooting at their own brethren. There's a time for a show of force to show you're serious, then there's a time for negotiation. I think there's never a reasonable time for war, hardly ever.
What would you like to see the church do now?
Well, I think it's inevitable that the main churches in America, the Protestant and the Catholic churches, will inevitably be for nonviolence, because they go along with what I said earlier, that you don't really solve things by violence. You just commit destruction and death and suffering and all the rest. I think the churches are in a good position to mediate. And on the other hand, the churches didn't do very much when World War II was coming on, not as much as they should, I think, to influence governments to talk instead of start shooting. But there's a time when with a tyrant and with an unjust tyrant and a braggadocio tyrant, you simply have to say, you aren't going to get away with this. Now, we've got plenty of ways of stopping you, but we don't want to hurt your people. So either we're going to have a conversation or a war. A conversation would be much better, and it would get us further. And I think the churches are promoting that stance.
Father Theodore Hesburgh is my guest, and he's written a new memoir, which is called God, Country, Notre Dame. When you were getting started, did you see yourself as apt to live the life of a parish priest, or did you think that you would be heading up an organization or, you know, let alone a large university?
Terry, it was a curious kind of thing. I joined a religious order, and I took the vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Now, the toughest of those is obedience, because you do what you're told to do, like in the Marines. You don't solve your problems your own personal life. Well, they asked me first, did I want to go out and get a doctorate in theology? And I said, not really. I'd like to be a chaplain in the Navy. The war was on. And they said, well, go out and get a doctorate in theology. So I did it quickly. I cut a year off the three-year program, and I'd already had 4 years of theology. And when I finished, again, I went and said, they said, well, would you like to go on active work or to teach? And I said, I'd rather go on active pastoral work. I still would like to be a chaplain in the Navy. There's still a war going on. And they told me to go teach at Notre Dame, 1945. They were probably right, because the war was over before I got through the first semester of teaching. But then I got to love teaching, and of course I've always loved theology, and And then one day the president at that point, my predecessor, a fellow named Father John Kavanaugh, said, "Ted, how would you like to get into administration?" And I said, "That's the last thing in the world I want to do. I didn't really want to teach, but now I love teaching. I love working with the students and having all these different clubs and activities going on, and I'm writing a book on theology for college students, and I think I'm doing pretty well, so why don't you leave me alone?" Well, the next year I was made executive vice president, and 3 years later president. So I didn't foresee any of that, to answer your question. In fact, I resisted it.
One of the things you did early on when you took over at Notre Dame was to change the board from a clerical board to a lay board. What were some of the restrictions set down by the Vatican that you didn't think the university should have to follow?
Well, the problem is that a university needs above all what I call academic freedom. It has to be, it lives in a world of ideas, and it has to be free to challenge ideas, and it has to be challenge a few sacred cows. And I had come into one circumstance where we were publishing a book on, I suppose, church and state, and I thought it was a good book. And one of the cardinals in the Vatican thought it was not a good book because it was against what he had been saying in a book he had written. So they said, "You shouldn't publish that book." And I said, "We're a university, we have academic freedom, and we're going to publish it." So then, of course, he called up my boss, who lived in Rome, and said, "Tell him to quiet down." And I just told my boss the same thing, that if he wanted to fire me, that was his privilege. But as long as I was president, there was going to be academic freedom in this university. And the only way they were going to change me on this was to remove me. Well, they didn't remove me. The book sold out, 6,000 copies, and everybody was reasonably happy. But it struck me at that point that an organization as big as a Catholic university, which is totally faithful to the church and wants to go on and be a Catholic university, needs a lot of elbow room, and I thought we'd have more elbow room if we were run by lay people. So what we did, we simply set up a board of trustees who had been advisors to the university, 50 of them from all parts of the country and overseas, some Protestants as well as Catholics, Jews, black and white, Hispanic. We tried to get a composite board that was mainly Catholic, mainly Notre Dame alumni, but did have a flavor of what the United States was like. And we simply put it to the order that we should turn the whole place, worth over $1 billion, over to this board to govern. And I think it's worked very, very well. In fact, practically every university, every Catholic hospital, now many Catholic parochial schools are going this route.
My guest is Father Theodore Hesburgh, and he's written a new autobiography, which is called God, Country, Notre Dame. And he was the president of Notre Dame University for 35 years. He retired in 1987. You were president of Notre Dame during one of the most difficult periods for university presidents, and I'm thinking of the student protests of the late 1960s. You decided that you really needed to draw the line and hold the line. Of course, you had to decide where you were going to draw the line. You issued a statement to the students saying that anyone or any group that substitutes force for rational persuasion, be it violent or nonviolent, will be given 15 minutes of meditation to cease and desist. And if they didn't cease and desist, then what?
Then they got suspended from the university for that particular semester. Now, then we gave them 5 minutes more to think about it some more and said, if you're still impeding the rights of other people or blocking the normal life of the university and education, we are going to be expelled from the university for good. Now, after I said that, one group of a dozen youngsters came to see me the night before, and they said, we don't like the fact that their youngsters in the next 3 days are going to be going in to look for jobs in CIA or Dow Chemical. And I said, well, you've got a right to run up and down and carry your signs and do whatever you want to try to persuade them not to do that. But if they want to do it, that's their right. They're free and you're free, and I've got to protect both the freedom, your freedom and their freedom. Well, as a matter of fact, they went and lay down in front of the door going into the interview room, and I told them, that is not physical violence, but it's moral violence. Nobody's going to walk on your bodies to get into an office. I wouldn't walk on them to get into my office. So you got 15 minutes to cease and desist and get out of here and pick up your ID cards right now. Well, they were still there 15 minutes later, and the dean of students said, okay, you're out for the semester. Now we're down to the short strokes. You've got 5 minutes more, and if you're still here doing this, blocking the rights of others in this fashion, 5 minutes from now, you're going to be out of the university for good. Well, when he came back in 5 minutes, they were gone, and that was the end of the test.
So those students were expelled? Suspended?
For the semester. Yeah. They all graduated. They came back the next semester and made up their work.
How did you decide where to draw the line?
It seemed to me, Terry, that in a university, you've got a wide variety of opinions about what's good and bad for the university, for education. A university is one of the few places you can disagree without being disagreeable nowadays. And I felt that while I really sympathize with many of the things they were protesting against, these students that were causing the upset, and I said in some of these things, I'll go out there and carry a sign with you. If you're upholding the poor in the richest society on earth, or you're upholding minorities who are not getting their full civil rights, or if you're upset about the war, so am I, I'll be with you. But there are other people here who think differently and who want to go on with a normal educational procedure, and you can't be breaking into classrooms or burning buildings or doing that kind of thing because that's against their freedom. And I felt in a way, as long as I was honest with them, but said, here's where you draw the line. You draw the line when you are impeding the rights of other people. Now, I'll uphold your rights to protest, but you've got to protest in a way that doesn't destroy the rights of other people to do what they legitimately want to do. I felt that's where the line ought to be drawn, and also to totally outlaw violence, which has no place in a university or anywhere else for that matter.
The demonstration that you had referred to before of the students who were protesting Dow and the CIA recruiting on campus, that was one of the very controversial issues on campus at the time. What was your defense for letting Dow, which was the manufacturer of napalm, and the CIA to recruit on campus?
Well, it was our feeling that Dow wasn't just doing one thing. And CIA had done some things that were, I had seen in my own life, were very important that no one else could do, including saving the life of Napoleon Duarte when he was about to be shot at dawn. And they stepped in and managed to stop that. I had seen the CIA do things abroad where at times there was no other agency that could find the facts on whether there's going to be a massacre or not, for example, in Haiti on one occasion. So it's easy to just say CIA is bad, but there are times when you need information and you need linkages where you can stop something bad from happening if it's going to hurt a lot of people. And I think at that point it seemed to me that if youngsters wanted to do that kind of work, that was their option. You shouldn't say to them you can't interview with them even, or even ask them what they're doing or why they're doing it, etc. It seemed to me it was a valid thing. We had probably every large corporation on earth coming in for interviews, and the students had the widest possible choice. But if someone wanted to work for Dow, I'm quite sure they would have said, I'll work for you, but I'm not going to make napalm.
One of the controversies on the Notre Dame campus, and this was a controversy on many campuses in the 60s, was the existence of ROTC training. And a lot of students at the time felt that the university campus was no place for a military training program. You defended the presence of ROTC on campus, although there were protests against it by your students. And I'm sure there still is an ROTC program there today. Why do you think the students were wrong in finding
that
incompatible?
Well, on this one, Terry, I believe that according to our Constitution, we're always going to have to defend the country. I mean, and there's always going to be an armed forces in this country. I don't think it has to be anywhere near as large as it is, if you ask me that. But in any case, there is going to be an armed forces, and that's a legitimate part of every country's self-protection, if you will, same as we have policemen on the beat. Now, I felt that having done a lot of work in the services, that you can always tell the quality of life of the service and the quality of your armed forces gets back to the quality of the officers. And it seemed to me that I'd rather be producing officers who were intelligent, who understood what peace was all about, who were against blind violence, who had ideals for this country and upholding of human rights, who were people of high integrity. I'd rather have that kind of person as in the officer corps than some guy from Podunk who never heard the word peace or understood what it was really about. And I would like intelligent, bright, philosophical, even theological theologically wise people conducting leadership in the armed forces. That's why I was for it, and I think it makes sense. I can understand people arguing against it. That's their privilege.
What do you think was the most difficult judgment call you had to make during the days of the student protests?
Probably when to go along and join them, and when to say you're out of line and we can't do this and I'm going to have to stop it.
And what do you think you learned from those years that you applied to quieter years on campus?
Well, I learned that leadership is terribly important. I remember calling the University of Chicago's president. His office had been occupied for 2 weeks, and finally they got through it, and the youngsters left, and they actually expelled them. But I said, how did you handle that? And he said, every morning I get up and said, what's the worst thing I could do today, like call the cops, and I didn't do it. I learned that pretty quickly.
Did you ever call the cops?
No, never called the cops, never prosecuted a student.
Why not?
And never lost a building.
Why did you draw the line against calling the cops? That was always a big issue on campus, whether it would be...
Well, I just felt we ought to be able to handle our own problems. We have our own internal security on the campus, of course, but they're not swinging clubs and things like that. And in a university, if you listen to people, if you're available, and I was always available till about 3 o'clock in the morning every day, and they knew they could get to me, and all they had to do is knock on the door and get in, so they couldn't say they weren't being heard. I disagreed with them time to time, but they always could be heard, and I knew where they were coming from.
I'd like to ask you about a stand that you took that was, I believe, controversial even when you left, you know, as late as 1987, and that was that you didn't move to divest the university of its holdings in South African-based business. A lot of universities did try to divest. What was your reason for not doing it?
Well, first of all, we did divest of about half of the holdings, I would say.
I see.
What we did, we said we will not do business with any bank who does business with the government of South Africa. That got rid of a lot of bank stocks and bonds. Secondly, I wrote a letter to every company in which we invested and said, are you following the Sullivan principles, which were against apartheid in the workplace? Are you treating all of your black workers in South Africa the same as you're treating your white workers? If they wrote back and said, no, we aren't, we divested. And we divested from a number of companies who wrote back and said we aren't. Those that said we're doing all of these things, I thought were a force for good in South Africa. They were giving an example that you could repudiate apartheid in the workplace and still have a successful business. And I thought that's something that deserves support, not just being automatically divested because someone said divestiture is a good thing to do.
In your book, you say that you offered mass every day except for one. What was that one day?
Well, in the old days, you're probably too young to understand this, Terry, or remember this, but in the old days, you had a fast from midnight. You couldn't even take a drink of water if you're going to say mass the next day. And I was in a hospital most of the night because one of my friends was having a cesarean, and I baptized the child when it was taken by cesarean at 3 pounds, 8 ounces. And I'd been walking back and forth all night with a father, and I walked by a drinking fountain without thinking, took a drink of water, and that was against the rules in those days. Thank God we don't have that rule anymore.
When was it changed?
It was changed during Vatican Council II back in the 60s.
How did Vatican II change your life?
Oh, for the better. First of all, it became a lot easier for offering mass in places that not necessarily a church. And I was always traveling all over the world and constantly finding myself in the boondocks where there wasn't a church. Secondly, you could say mass at any time of the day or night, which was helpful. Thirdly, you didn't have that rule of fasting from midnight and saying mass before noon the next day. In a personal way, I enjoy more saying my breviary, which is a prayer the priest says every day, about a half hour or so, in English rather than in Latin. It was briefed. It was made a little more brief. It used to be longer. But I just find I pray better in my own language than in Latin. Some people may dispute that, but that's the way I feel about it. I know Latin more than most people. Anyway, having lived pre-Vatican II and post-Vatican II, I find the church much more open, much more flexible, much more enjoyable, and much more, say, ecumenical, opening up to other peoples and other religions, and much more concerned with social justice in the world, and much more open to what's good in the world rather than say the world is totally evil.
A lot of nuns and priests have left the clergy because of the vow of celibacy, because they didn't want to uphold the vow of chastity. You say that celibacy has actually been very liberating for you.
That's right, Terry, and people might say that's silly, but it isn't. Let me just put it as quickly as I can. First of all, I think that celibacy is a gift of God, and it doesn't come easily necessarily. You've got to work at it, and you can't get yourself in all kinds of compromising situations if you're going to keep celibate, and you've got to be fairly careful of your own personal life. But granting that you do that, celibacy somehow makes you open to everybody because you're not committed to somebody. In other words, someone calls me in trouble in the middle of the night, I pick up and go. Well, you say a doctor does that too. Yeah, but he's got to explain why he's going and might say let somebody else do it. But the fact is that people are somewhat impressed, I have found in my own life, by the fact that you really do belong to everybody, that you really are celibate, that you don't have restrictions on doing anything that might be dangerous or demand a lot of your time or monopolize you at times. And people also have a certain confidence in that. I know this is going to sound curious, but I don't think it is. I'd say most of the work I've done around the country and around the world with other people, most of them aren't Catholic. And yet they're all married, and they all very often bring their wives to meetings. And they often ask me, the guys would, how come all our wives are very free with you and they seem to like you better than the rest of the guys around here? And I said, I think it's very simple. I'm not a threat to them. They know I'm celibate. They know that that I'm open to everybody, but they know I'm not going to play games with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in a way, they respected that in some way more than the fact that I offered Mass every day and that I said my breviary every day, although those in a sense were more related to my priesthood.
In your book, you write that you don't think you've had more than half a dozen sleepless nights in your life, and that at night you put your worries aside, you say your prayers, and you go to sleep. I think some of us are kind of constitutionally unable to put our worries aside at night. Do you have, how do you think you've been able to do that?
Well, first of all, I have felt that when you're in a position of responsibility, you have to make a lot of decisions. You're going to go crazy if you go back and try to remake them. So I try to live every moment for the moment and not worry about what I decided last week or yesterday or this morning, and not to worry about what I've got to do this afternoon and tomorrow and next week. As far as going to sleep when the day's over, it's over. Now, I do one more thing. You ask for advice, I'll give it to you. But Catholics have a thing called the Rosary, which is a kind of repetition of the Our Father and Ten Hail Marys. And it's, in a way, almost like something in Eastern religions call a mantra. But in a way, saying the Rosary very often, like last night, I didn't get through it. I mean, I wake up in the middle of the night and sometimes, and there's the Rosary there, and I fell asleep. When I was a youngster, this is going to sound sentimental, but I'll say it anyway. When I was a youngster, my Irish mother used to say, just say the Rosary every night, and if you fall asleep, the angels will finish it for you. It's funny, but that's an Irish mother for you.
Well, Theodore Hesburgh, thank you very much for talking with us. Theodore Hesburgh's new book is called God, Country, Notre Dame.